Do you, Chris, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to barrage her with obscure facts concerning comics, movies, TV shows, and toys?
I do.
And Cindy, do you take this man-child to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to humor him by engaging him in his obsessive ramblings, for better or worse, in pre-crisis or in post?
Sure, why not?
Then by the power invested in me by the High Father of the Fourth World, I now pronounce you Supermates. You may podcast with the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 25 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And today we're going to continue our one-year anniversary celebration looking at famous superhero wedding issues. Last time we handled Aquaman and Mera, Mr. Fantastic, Invisible Girl, and Donna Troy, and the normal dude she married, Terry Long. This time, as in the second part of our original couples two-parter that started off the show, we covered Spider-Man and Superman, and so we're going to do that again this time. So, without a lot of preamble, because we did that last time, we're just going to jump right into it.
Alrighty. First up is Amazing Spider-Man Annual Number 21, released in 1987, on sale June 9th, 1987, entitled The Wedding.
Jim Shooter, plot editor-in-chief, David Michelinie, script, Paul Ryan, pencils, Vince Coletta, inks, Rick Parker, lettering, Bob Sharon, colors, Jim Salakrup, editor.
Spider-Man is busier than normal. After quelling a hostage situation perpetrated by his old foe, Electro, he nabs a trio of fleeing bank robbers and aids rescue workers at a warehouse fire. Later that night, Peter Parker returns home to his apartment at 410 Chelsea Street, where he begins to develop the photos he snapped of Spider-Man in action. Peter is hoping the extra photos he snaps will help pay for his impending nuptials.
The bride-to-be, Mary Jane Watson, stops by Peter's apartment briefly, but soon dashes off to a waiting limo on her way to a photo shoot. Peter wonders if he can keep up with her glamorous lifestyle when they are wed. The next day, Peter manages to sell the photos to Daily Bugle managing editor Joe Robbie Robertson, who then leads Peter to a surprise wedding party in his honor. Even Peter's old boss and Spider-Man's number one annoyance, Bugle publisher J. Jonah Jameson, stops by to wish Peter well and give him some advice. Surprisingly, he also signs a bonus check for Peter when pushed by Robbie.
That night at MJ's apartment, thanks to his bonus, Peter presents his fiancée with a proper ring while suspended from the ceiling. Over dinner, the two begin to discuss their apprehension about marriage. Foreshadowing there of the discussion to come, but a ringing phone interrupts them. Mary Jane's old Hollywood friend, Bruce, is hoping she'll drop the marriage idea and go to his villa in the south of France. MJ leaves in a limo once more, and Peter is once again left wondering if he's making the right decision.
Later, as MJ leaves the offices of her friend, fashion designer Willie Smith, a strange man hands her a tape and leads her to a Ferrari, left to her by her amorous and loaded friend, Bruce. Inside the glove box are those tickets for Paris.
That evening, Peter visits his Aunt May to tell her the news. He looks through some old scrapbooks and is reminded of his origins as Spider-Man and of his lost love, Gwen Stacy. MJ and her Aunt Anna arrive, and the young couple reveal their plans to their happy guardians.
After they leave May's house, MJ is picked up by Bruce in his Ferrari. An impatient Peter waits for word from her all night until she finally arrives early the next morning. Looking for a quiet place to think, Peter, as Spider-Man, takes her to the top of the Empire State Building. Peter takes MJ home and stays up all night, pondering this massive life change while staring at a photo of Gwen.
The next morning, a happy MJ calls to tell Peter about her recently arrived wedding dress, a Willie Smith original. But Peter is distracted by his troubling thoughts, even as the couple sign their marriage license and go out to dinner. The following night, at his old hangout, the Coffee Bean, Peter admits to his old friends Flash Thompson and Harry Osborn that he's having some serious doubts about the wedding. Flash eventually convinces Peter to go for it while MJ attends a bachelorette party of her own. Leaving the party, she accepts another ride from Bruce and realizes she has a very important decision to make.
The night before his impending big day, Peter's dreams are haunted by a twisted version of his wedding, complete with superheroes and villains, and his old red and blue Spidey outfit. He awakens screaming as his enemies close in on Mary Jane. He then swings to the Brooklyn Bridge, where he once again stares and talks to the photo of Gwen, asking for her guidance.
The big day arrives and the guests are gathered on the courthouse steps on Center Street, but there's no bride and no groom. MJ arrives in Bruce's limo wearing her wedding dress and briefly panics before a shoeless Peter, fresh from web-slinging and wall-crawling, runs up. At last, the two are wed.
Afterwards, everyone attends the reception held by none other than J. Jonah Jameson, who mentions it makes a great tax write-off. When Peter tells his new wife he wishes he could afford to take her on a fancy honeymoon, MJ produces those first-class tickets to Paris.
2 weeks later, and the happy couple arrive back to 410 Chelsea Street and to their new life as man and wife. I don't know where to begin with this. I mean, this is one of those classic things that all the buttons are there, all the flags are there to say they shouldn't be doing this, but then they keep doing it because they're on this ride. And they're like, well, this is what we said we were going to do, so let's do it. Doesn't matter what our gut's telling us.
Right. Yeah, I think that partially comes from the genesis of this, the whole idea of them getting married. The legend has it Stan Lee planned to marry them in the comic strip. Stan Lee has always written the Spider-Man comic strip and still does to this day. And he had geared it to more of a soap opera type style than the standard comics because it worked better with the way this comic strips are done today. Legend has it he was at a panel with Jim Shooter, who was then the editor-in-chief of Marvel, and he brought up the wedding idea, and Jim Shooter asked the fans in attendance, well, what do you guys think? Should they get married in the comics? And they apparently and roared and clapped, and so then he decided to do it. And they decided to have a synergistic wedding around the same time in the comic strip and the comic. And there was even a live-action wedding with actors at New York Shea Stadium. The comic strip wedding ran on June 21st, and then the live event happened on June the 5th. So technically the live one came first, and then this one came out, what did we say, was it like June the 9th or something like that? Okay, this one came out June the 9th. So you had the live-action one, the comic one, and then the
comic strip.
So it kind of came in reverse order of how they came up with it.
Right.
But interestingly enough, although Jim Shooter is listed as plotter on this and editor-in-chief, by the time this came out, he was either out the door or pretty much out the door and ousted from Marvel. So the engagement was very short for Peter and MJ. He had proposed abruptly to her in Amazing Spider-Man number 290 only 4 months earlier. And then
she know when he proposed that he was Spider-Man?
Yeah, a few years earlier, they brought Mary Jane back to the comics. She had been out of the comics for years. And, I mean, just only making very brief appearances. I think she left after the last time Peter proposed to her, which was in the late 70s. I think that was during Marv Wolfman's run. And like 79 or something like that. And she had only been in the comics very sporadically. And she came back into his life and revealed that she always knew he was Spider-Man. And at that point they tried to give Mary Jane some depth, you know, that she wasn't just the shallow party girl, that she had this, abusive childhood, and that she knew Peter was Spider-Man. That's one reason why she kept rejecting him. But they weren't really the couple in the comic book. I mean, he was off and on with the Black Cat, and it was just a real abrupt that he proposed to her in the comic in issue number 290. And so
there wasn't that history there like the couple we're going to discuss later.
Right. There wasn't that natural progression that you felt like that it was natural. I mean, it honestly wasn't. It was kind of like, what? It's just, and
To me, reading this comic and everything else, this is just me psychoanalyzing things, but it seems like to me, unlike other comic book superhero, other comic book wives who married their grooms, she was marrying Spider-Man. She was marrying the idea of Spider-Man, the glamour, the high of it, because that's what she was used to as far as with her supermodel career. Whereas these other superhero wives, they were marrying the men that they really were.
Mm.
She was marrying the public facade.
Well, maybe. Now, if he had married the Black Cat, that was exactly what it would have been, because she did not have any interest in Peter Parker. When he unmasked in front of her, she was just like, oh, well, I don't want to know who you are. You know, it was kind of, in a way, it was kind of subtextually creepy and kind of freaky, if you think about it. It's like, you know, freaky cosplay love or something. But, yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, you know, I just think that it was just one of those cases where, and I think we're putting a cart before the horse. Let's go over some of the details, and then we'll kind of surmise what we thought of it at the end.
All right.
Yeah. So, first off, there's two covers for the book.
Mm-hmm.
The newsstand version features Spider-Man standing with Mary Jane in his classic red and blue costume, with heroes and villains in the back of them squaring off. And then the direct comic shop version has Peter with Mary Jane and their wedding party and guests are behind them. So they kind of, you know, they kind of split the difference between the Tales of the Teen Titans number 50 type cover with Donna and Terry and no superheroes, you know, and then they did the Spider-Man in her cover too. So they're both by John Romita Sr., and they're, you know, they look just classically iconic, which you would expect from him, and you really wish he'd drawn the entire comic book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, first off, Spider-Man is in the black costume in this entire story.
Right, that was the first thing I said,
It's the cloth version that the Black Cat had made for him, which is kind of interesting. You pointed out to me when you were reading, it's like, is Electro supposed to be, like, really intelligent?
I mean, I don't know, because I don't, like I said, I don't read Marvel. I really don't.
Right.
And he was like, so far, so good. The plan to have you boys rescue me from that non-conductive police van worked perfectly. And now that I'm free, the world will once again know the terrible power of Electro. Come, there's havoc to be wrought. I mean, what?
Yeah, I don't remember Electro, you know, speaking so eloquently. Now, I could be wrong, and Andy Leyland's probably screaming at the you know, his MP3 player of choice and saying, you're wrong. But I don't remember him, you know, he was a electrical lineman that got, you know, that's how he got his power. So, I mean, I don't know. It just seemed kind of off. But, you know, clearly the opening pages, the action sequence with Electro and him stopping the burglars, they were to satisfy the passing comic fan who may be turned off by a wedding issue. They work in that regard, but
yeah, but
one thing about it, I always wondered, why didn't Peter just move in with Mary Jane instead of vice versa? He's always talking about, you know, the dump he lives in, and is she going to, can I keep up with her lifestyle? Well, why don't you live in her apartment, you know? And I guess,
why did they?
I don't know.
I mean,
was
her apartment part of her modeling gig, or was, I mean,
I don't know. I mean, eventually they got another apartment, and there was some big storyline. They got this really nice apartment because of this this fan of hers who ended up being a stalker. And then when he was arrested for being a stalker, they lost their apartment and all this and that. And I think they lived with Aunt May again for a while until they got back on their feet. But yeah, I never got that. At the bachelor, the party they have at the Daily Bugle in his honor, Peter calls Jameson a wise man. This guy created the Scorpion. He financed a slew of spider slayers. He's been nothing but a pain in the neck to him for 20-some years. Why in God's name would he ever say he was a wise man?
And what kids mean is they're like, oh, I'm not, you know, he says, I'm not such an ogre. But then at the end of it, you know, on the one panel, he says, oh, and Miss Hotchkiss, do remember to take down the names of everyone here, won't you? I'd hate to dock someone who didn't attend. So anybody that came to the party, he's docking their pay.
Yeah, I mean, that's, like, again, that's just, but Peter and his thought balloons, like, I don't know. There's just quite a bit of stuff that's just off about this issue to make it happen, I think. The scene with Betty Brant is weird. Ned Leeds had just been revealed to be the Hobgoblin and killed in the same issue, in spite of how, I think that was written by Jim Owsley / Christopher Priest, the guys who use both names. Roger Stern had created him, and then Tom DeFalco took over, and they both had different ideas of who the Hobgoblin would be, but neither one of them was Ned Leeds. Ned Leeds was meant to be a red herring. and they like revealed him to be the Hobgoblin and killed him in the same issue. It was like, or no, they killed Ned Leeds. That's what it was. They killed Ned Leeds and then later revealed that he had been the Hobgoblin. So this total, after all this build up for years, this total just let the air out of the, you know, room kind of revelation. It just sucked. But Betty's like, oh, me and Ned will be there. You know, it's like creepy. She thinks her dead husband's still alive.
But I mean, why doesn't he go and tell somebody, you know, the person you got working here? She's crackers. She thinks her dead husband's still alive.
Well, I'll tell you a good one. This is one Andy Leyland brought up on a, it was on a Views from the Long Box with him and Michael Bailey on Michael Bailey's show, that Ned and Betty were separated for a while, and apparently her and Peter knocked boots. This was back in the late 70s. This was their Marv Wolfman's run, because that Betty was his first love, you know, in the Lee Ditko era, but don't make it right, man, you know. So especially speaking of don't make it right, just like you said, okay, you know, they're having dinner and they're days away from their wedding and they're both having serious doubts. And not, it's not just cold feet. They're having serious doubts. You know, don't get married. And shouldn't Peter be a little more concerned about this Bruce?
I mean, this guy, days away from wedding, and she's out for all hours and just, like, what?
Hopping in the car with him and taking his car and, you know, at one point.
Well, and here's the thing. I have serious issue about it. Mary Jane is approached by somebody in a trench coat and fedora and says, I was told to give you this tape you can listen to in the Ferrari over there. The keys are in it. But what? Good day, miss. Dummy gets in the car. I mean, it could blow up. It could take off. Somebody could be in the back. You know, she's, what? Does she not have a brain in her head?
Like you pointed out, that's dangerous enough for anybody to do. But when you know your fiancé's Spider-Man and he has tons of enemies.
She's like, oh, what the heck? And I'm like, really? Why didn't you get your neck snapped?
Oh, snap, because Jerry Conway liked her better. He did not like Gwen. She was too boring. He liked Mary Jane. That's why. Willie Smith was a real fashion designer, and he did indeed design Mary Jane's dress, but he unfortunately passed away before this issue, the strip, or the live-action wedding took place. So.
Mm.
And, you know, Mary Jane does seem to be actually considering Bruce's offer a little too seriously. For my
several
taste.
Times. I mean, not just here, but there, you know, she's like, well, maybe, I don't know. But maybe, I don't know. If you have that much reservations, and especially this close, you're not doing the right thing.
Right. You know, as much as MJ's, you know, struggling with her feelings for Bruce, I mean, Peter's, you know, obsessed with his dead girlfriend, so. You know,
I'm sorry, but to me, how much time was there between Gwen's death and him starting?
Well, you know, sliding timeline, who knows how many years it was. But I mean, it's publishing wise, it's been, oh, it's been, you know, 10, 12 years. So, you know, I mean, so that might be a year or two in his life, which I mean, I understand that. But it's just if they just had him think about it one time. But the fact that he repeatedly, they just keep showing her picture, and he repeatedly looks at it, it's just like, okay, dude, you're not over her yet.
You know, no.
And I mean, her ghost hung over them the entire time they had him married. I think that's one reason why J. Michael Straczynski did that Sins of the Past storyline to basically taint Gwen so she would not be held up on this pedestal. And so him and Mary Jane could... You know, that's the one where her and Norman Osborn were knocking boots.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should never speak. Andy says never speak of it again, so sorry. But, but yeah.
I mean, to me, that's one of those things. I mean, he is still in love with Gwen, and MJ is the girl that he grew up with, and was like, well, I'll marry her.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, she really is second choice. I mean, there's no two ways about it. You know, they leave Aunt May's house, and she gets in a Ferrari, and Peter's pretty dense not knowing that Bruce is in that Ferrari. I mean, does his spider sense not, you know, I guess it wasn't a real threat, or his spider sense would have went off.
Well, I mean, to me, the spider sense is used when it's a physical threat, not when it's an emotional threat.
I was making a crack, but... The page where Peter visits Flash in the hospital, I detect the work of Jim Mooney in that, on those pages. I don't know. It does not look like the rest of the book, which we'll get into that later. But Flash was in the hospital because he was drawn into the Hobgoblin storyline. And at one time, he was set up as a dupe to make people think he was the Hobgoblin. So that was another part of the Hobgoblin craziness going on. I got to say, Peter has a pretty pathetic bachelor party. You know, it's cool that they went back to the Coffee Bean because that's where they hung out during the Romita era. But, yeah. It was a nice twist that he got his most positive reinforcement from Flash because, you know, Flash tormented him in the earliest days of the book. So,
but, I mean, to me, it's he doesn't give him good advice. Well, you know what? You might have a slim chance of this going, so go ahead and do it. Go ahead and take vows before God that say, I'm going to love you forever. You know, I don't really mean it, but, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say it because, you know, it really might work out. What?
And Flash is like, I know I haven't had a lot of luck with relationships, but listen to me.
I mean.
Although the line that kills me in the book is at her bachelor party when Mary Jane's handed a note. She's like, Bruce, will you ever stop and do I want you to?
I mean, that's the thing. She's like, well, you know. She's definitely friend-zoned it, Bruce.
Oh,
you know,
well,
if it doesn't work out with Peter, you know.
Gotcha. The dream sequence seems to be there just to get more heroes and villains in the, and the classic costume in the issue. It almost feels like John Romita drew the cover, mm-hmm. and then they're like, the two covers, and like, oh, man, the red and blue costume's not in this. And we need some heroes and villains. Oh, dream sequence, you know, that's just what it feels like. When the two actually wed, It looks like John Romita actually had some hand in that page. It's not credited anywhere, but it looks like it to me.
Mm. What kills me is when they get to the wedding, she even drives up in Bruce's car.
Yeah, he drives her to the wedding.
It makes you think.
Did she have one last?
And that's how she got the tickets for the honeymoon. I mean, come on!
It was before she was married. It doesn't count.
I immediately got that out of it. I was like, whoa, she's a, you know.
Yeah. I never have read the honeymoon story from Spectacular Spider-Man number 7. It took place between the last two pages. I never have read that, so I can't really comment. But, you know, overall, this whole issue just feels very rushed and very blah.
Mm-hmm.
It's just... It reads as if no one working on it was really that enthused with the idea. You know, I felt that way when I read it back in 1987, and I still feel that way now. You know, Jim Shooter did a lot of great things at Marvel. I mean, he's had some people that, you know, he has his detractors and he has his admirers. But toward the end of his time there as editor-in-chief, a lot of people said he became very enamored of his own ideas. Like, he did Secret Wars. He wrote that. It sold like hotcakes. So from then on, he wanted everything to feel like Secret Wars. And he started, you know, second-guessing people that he had trusted before and things like that. So I kind of wonder if this wasn't just, you know, this was his idea. He pushed it through. Everybody's like, okay, we'll do it, you know. And then they were stuck with it after he...
They should have... I mean, I'm sorry, but they should have made this like a dream sequence. If nothing else, I mean, pull a Bobby Ewing. I mean, this is just awful.
Well, eventually they did, but...
Well, this is true.
But, you know, and I didn't actually mind them married after the fact, but this wedding issue just reads... David Michelinie himself, I think, did really good stuff with it, and J.M. DeMatteis did some good stuff with their marriage. I mean, he wrote some good stories and made them a stronger couple. But here it's just... Their foundation of their marriage just seems very, very weak and mm-hmm. very rocky. And it's no, you know, I mean, with this one, I can almost kind of understand, you know, why some creators were so hell-bent to get rid of it.
Right.
Especially after rereading this, you know. I don't think the way they did it made any sense. That was ridiculous. But, you know, I can kind of almost understand why they did it, because if you go back and look at this and the issues that preceded, it just doesn't feel like a natural progression. Of where the mm-hmm. characters were going. Paul Ryan was the artist, the penciler on this, and he was never an overly dynamic artist, but he was a good, solid comic book artist. But his stuff here is very stiff. And I know this is early in his career, but I have a feeling that Vince Coletta just basically went to town on this. I don't know if he just, Ryan did just layouts, or Coletta went nuts with the eraser. Like we mentioned last time, he was known to erase and redraw stuff. It just has a very stiff feeling to it. It feels like a romance comic, like a generic romance comic. But, you know, romance comics often had really good art from guys like Dick Giordano, Alex Toth, and John Romita. He worked at DC doing romance comics for years before he went back to Marvel and did Spider-Man. So why didn't they give him this book? If he had drawn this book, I think it would have put it over the top and we wouldn't even be complaining about it.
But, I don't know. And the whole wedding thing, I'm sorry, getting married on the steps of the courthouse. What kind of planning is that? This is a wedding. I'm sorry, but this goes for this comic and for any other comic. You can tell that a bunch of dudes wrote these issues. Because they're like, I'm sorry, but there is all kinds of planning that goes into weddings. And no, y'all just don't know. No.
Well, we're going to take after that. Have you said all you want to say about this one?
Yeah, otherwise that they just weren't doing the right thing.
Right. I agree. I just, again, not to beat a dead horse, but I just really think that
Her dress is pretty, except for the shoulder to mid-arm cutout. That just doesn't work.
And you have, you have a Barbie.
Oh, I do. I have the Barbie, Mary Jane Watson Barbie. It's based on this. However, it doesn't have all the lace embellishments, but it does have that same shape.
Right.
And, I mean, it's a really cool doll, really done well. It actually comes with a little Spider-Man necklace mask. So. Yeah,
and I think on the back of it, it's got, if I remember right, I haven't looked at it before this, but it's got a image of, that was used to promote this, of Spider-Man swinging with Mary Jane in his arms, mm-hmm. and it's John Romita.
Right.
Which, again, it's like, John Romita should have drawn this. But, anyway, well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to tackle the first wedding of Superman and Lois Lane.
C-3PO.
Loki.
Mace Windu.
Dr. Bruce Banner.
Captain Rex.
Venom.
Princess Leia.
Jean Grey.
Darth Maul.
Nick Fury.
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Captain America.
Lando Calrissian.
Cyclops.
What do all these characters have in common?
Well, two of them were played by Samuel L. Jackson.
A couple of them were played by Hammer Films veterans Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee.
Come on, guys. You know this.
Well, of course we do, Jessica. Just like Mickey Mouse and Captain Jack Sparrow, they're all now Disney characters. Hello, I'm Tracy of the Disney Indiana podcast, and my co-host Scott and I enjoy talking about all aspects of the House of Mouse, and that includes their newest properties, Marvel and LucasArts.
We also talk about Disney resorts, the cruise line, theme parks, and whatever else Mickey has to offer.
Which includes movies, Imagineering, video games, and collectibles. You'll never know what we'll decide to talk about.
So check us out at www.disneyindiana.com or do a search for the Disney Indiana podcast on iTunes, because now we've got a lot more to talk about.
And don't forget about those other quote-unquote Disney characters like, well, Sully.
Fozzie Bear.
Buzz Lightyear.
Link Hogthrob.
Doug.
Janice.
Merida.
Pepe.
Bruce.
Ralph the Dog.
Wally.
The Disney Indiana podcast. Even after 5 years, we are still miles away from the nearest Main Street, USA. We are not listed on the map, but you can join us at www.disneyindiana.com.
Okay, so now we are going to discuss Action Comics number 484, June 1978, on sale March the 27th, 1978. Cover by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, and Dick Giordano.
Our story begins with a familiar monologue.
Yes, it's Superman, strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Superman, who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands, and who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper,
long ago decided that there was one woman in the world he loved so deeply that he had to have her by his side.
And so begins a series of astounding events revealed here for the first time, leading up to the momentous day when Superman takes a wife. Writer Cary Bates, penciler Kurt Swan, inker Joe Giella, letterer Ben Oda, colorist Tatjana Wood, Editor Julia Schwartz.
Our story narrator quickly corrects himself and informs us this tale takes place not on the usual Earth 1, but Earth 2. See, it makes sense. But anyway, it is set several years in that Earth's past. There, Superman encounters a squadron of flying robots called the Mechanical Marauders and makes short work of them. He is observed by Metropolis's newest menace and the master of the robots, Colonel Future, who vows to destroy the Man of Steel.
Superman returns to his job as Daily Star reporter Clark Kent. He foils another one of Lois Lane's schemes to expose his secret identity, but Lois still suspects her mild-mannered colleague is the Metropolis Marvel.
3 days later, Colonel Future's men bring the wizard before him. This former foe of the Justice Society of America is not impressed by the Colonel and displays his magical prowess to prove it. Future offers him Merlin's famed Glastonbury Blonde in exchange for the wizard's help in ridding the world of Superman.
The next day, Clark saves Lois's life from an errant laser beam fired by Colonel Future's goons and meant for an armored car. As Superman, he apprehends the fleeing felons, but soon disappears in a puff of smoke.
He reappears in a field outside of Metropolis, standing in an effigy of his own S-shield. There, the wizard, with his new, more powerful wand, casts a spell that makes the Man of Steel cease to exist. He disappears, leaving only his smoking symbol on the ground behind him.
Hours later, Clark Kent rises from the now cold markings and walks toward Metropolis.
With no memory of ever being Superman, Clark Kent's heroic nature emerges. Over the following weeks, the crusading reporter aids the police in bringing down many criminal organizations, all the while searching for clues regarding Superman's disappearance. The CF gang still eludes him, but Lois has taken notice of Clark's changed nature, and soon the two begin dating. Romance blossoms quickly, and the now emboldened Clark proposes to Lois, who accepts. The two are married before their friends and family and leave for a vacation, honeymoon, in the Bahamas.
There, Colonel Future enacts his revenge on the meddling reporter. His mini-sub fires a hail of machine gun bullets at Clark, much to Lois's horror. Seeing their target unharmed, the two assailants assume their weapons are defective and retreat. An anguished Lois greets her husband on the beach, but he has no knowledge of any harm being inflicted upon him, and no sign of them either. Lois's long-held suspicions return to the fore.
That night, she attempts to cut a lock of Clark's hair, only to break her scissors. Her husband is Superman, and on the flight back home, she deduces even he doesn't know it. Back to work at the Daily Star, Lois dives headlong into trying to track down the criminal behind her husband's amnesia. The trail leads to the wizard, now a derelict, left powerless by a lack of confidence, brought on by no one believing he destroyed Superman. Lois offers him a chance to prove himself.
The next morning, a sad Lois says goodbye to her husband and holds a press conference. There, the wizard reverses his spell, and an awakening Clark Kent disappears, only to reappear as Superman bursting from the ground in which he vanished. The Man of Steel lands at the press conference and makes short work of the once again confident wizard. Watching this all on his television, Colonel Future is not pleased.
Superman returns to his and Lois's apartment, only to find her packing. She believes that now that Superman is back, his duties will leave him no time for a wife, and that he would never have married her if not for the wizard. The Man of Tomorrow admits that if it weren't for the wizard, he would have never known how much he loved her. He proposes to her again, this time as Superman, and whisks her away to his secret citadel in the mountains outside the city. Exchanging traditional Kryptonian wedding vows before statues of his birth parents, Superman takes Lois as his wife.
So the cover on this one is awesome. It's gorgeous. It's Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
That's right. And Dick Giordano, so of course it is. The real cool thing about this is Lois is on Superman's shoulder. She's on one shoulder and on his right shoulder, and with his left arm, he's holding up a car, just like in Action Number One, which it mentions that. But Lois's legs are blocking his chest symbol,
mm-hmm.
So you have no idea this is the Earth 2 Superman. The only clue is you see the Daily Star building
in the corner, yeah.
Underneath as they fly through the air. I saw this comic advertised, house ad in comics I had at the time, and I was like 3. And I wanted it then, but I never got in and get it till years later, but we'll get into that later. But anyway, so Kurt Swan's opening splash has a late golden, early Silver Age look to it. as it should, since this story takes place in the early 50s. Mm-hmm. Swan actually drew Superman comics back then, but his style has evolved considerably by this point. Inker Joe Giella, he softens and simplifies Swan's work quite a bit. I'm not usually like a big fan of his. I mean, he inked a lot of important DC books in the Silver Age, but I just was never a huge fan of his style. I thought it was kind of heavy-handed, but it really works to kind of give that older look. And I love the use of the classic TV show opening dialogue. This works for me because I always thought of the Earth 2 Superman as George Reeves, mm-hmm. and the Earth 1 Superman as Christopher Reeve. I had no exposure to Kirk Allen when I was little.
Right.
So I guess it makes more sense for him to be the Earth 2 Superman, but we got a lot more Superman out of George. So I can actually hear George Reeves' voice as I read this comic. Of course, we get the explanation of Earth 1 and Earth 2. See, Marv Wolfman? No one had any trouble figuring this out. I'm just putting it out there.
See? No worries.
No worries. The mechanical marauders that we see, they're based on the mechanical monsters from the Fleischer cartoon.
See, I thought that too.
The Superman Fleischer cartoon, yeah. So that was cool that they worked them in. Colonel Future looks like a reject from a 30s sci-fi pulp magazine, but, you know, it works.
I don't know, it kind of made me think of the Flash Gordon, the big sons and stuff.
Yeah,
that's
he looks like something, somebody walked off a Buster Crab movie series.
Yeah, that's immediately what I thought of.
Yeah, he definitely does. Or he could be on the Kryptonian Council in the George Reeves, the pilot episode mm-hmm. of Superman, because they all are wearing, like, one guy's wearing Buster Crab's outfit, another guy's wearing Tom Tyler's Captain Marvel outfit. It's like prop department crazy. So Colonel Future actually is a recurring villain for a while in the follow-up feature, Mr. and Mrs. Superman, that starts right after this. Mm. And they eventually take him down. Swan actually puts a little bit of Wayne Boring in his Clark and Superman at times in this. Boring was actually the primary Superman artist of the late 40s through the 50s before Swan became the main guy in the 60s. Of course, the Wizard is a JSA foe, but Superman had never encountered him in any published story before, because back then Superman was just an honorary member of the JSA. He only appeared in just a handful of stories in the 40s.
Well, and you're right. The next part where we've talked about the bit where the Wizard turns the room upside down was effective, but disorienting. I almost turned the comic upside down at first. I thought, it's a misprint. Oh, and then I was like, oh, wait.
Word balloons are in the right.
Yeah.
They're right, correct, but the people are upside down.
Yeah, because when I first looked down, I went, what? Oh, okay.
There's a cute little bit where Clark, after Lois almost gets zapped by the laser beam, Clark changes in an alley, and when he rips his shirt open, he knocks some mugger out with his elbows.
Oh, yeah.
And he never even knows he's there. The Earth 2 Superman, one thing I always liked about the Earth 2 Superman is they kept that headstrong personality from his earliest adventures and gave it to him, gave it to, you know, that Superman, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
He was always more headstrong. He actually tells the Wizard, "You may be a magic man, but I'm a Superman. No force on Earth can harm me." I mean, you know. I'm Superman, damn it. But Superman disappearing into the ground and then reappearing at Clark is downright eerie. It reminds me of the Sand Superman from the 70s.
It reminded me of Superman 3.
Me too, yeah.
I mean, it did. That's immediately what I thought of. I was like, when they separated.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it? Wasn't a little bit of that from used in Superman 3, yeah. And then crusading Clark Kent reminds me even more of George Reeves' often no-nonsense take on Clark.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which, you know, they'd only have him be kind of wimpy and nebbish when they needed to. Otherwise, he was always, you know, in Inspector Henderson's office beating on the desk saying, "Why can't we catch these guys?
Right,
we got to do
right."
You know, so this reminded me of that.
I don't know. I mean, this always, when I think of George Reeves, and I mean, this is just a personal little aside, but that's my dad. My dad looked like George Reeves.
When he was young, yeah.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. When Clark and Lois marry, we see Lois's niece, Susie Tompkins, they actually point her out. She was a regular pain in the neck in the Superman comics of the time.
Mm.
Oddly enough, we don't see Batman and Robin, which they make a big point a few years later that Lois and Clark attend Bruce and Selina Kyle Wayne's wedding in the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature.
Right.
They actually show them at the wedding, so it's kind of weird that you don't see Batman and Robin there, but oh well. So they go on their honeymoon, and Clark is attacked, you know, shot at from this submarine. I can buy him not feeling the bullets, but wouldn't he hear them?
The roar of the ocean?
But maybe the spell.
And then Lois sees everything that happens. So,
right.
And she's on the beach, so.
Maybe the spell is so effective it just erases any thought he would even have considering he's Superman. You know,
I don't know.
I mean, clearly the spell wasn't supposed to make his alter ego rise back up. You know,
right.
That was a side effect the wizard didn't think would happen.
To me, it's one of those cases. I mean, you honestly have, even though the wizard got rid of quote-unquote Superman, you still have Clark Kent, who's a good man,
right,
who becomes the Crusader. It just reveals his true nature.
Right.
To me, that's all the wizard's spell did.
Right.
It tore away the facade of Superman and left what he really is.
Good point. I like that. The old scissor trick Lois uses reminded me of the classic Superman-Batman team-up where they... The first World's Finest issue where they try to convince her that Bruce Wayne is Superman because she thinks that Clark Kent's Superman.
Mm-hmm.
She sees him change. And at one point she tries to cut his hair and that Robin's rigged the scissors to break when she cuts his... So, oh, Bruce Wayne's Superman. That's what made me think of.
Oh, okay.
But here it actually works. You know, it might have been a bit of a leap for Lois to find the wizard like she did, but, you know, she is supposed to be the best damn reporter in Metropolis, so, you know.
Right.
Superman shows up and just pimp
just
slap.
Just let it go. It's in the script.
Yeah, right. Superman shows up and just pimp slaps the wizard.
Oh, I know. Didn't punch him, you know, just...
He's like, I'm going to get a new secret society, and I got my confidence back. And Superman's like, shut up! You know?
Shut up, Ralphie.
Yes. So he takes Lois to the Secret Citadel, which was Superman's Golden Age headquarters. That shows up again in the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature and in All-Star Squadron, so... kids like me got to see it in the 80s, so that was cool. The Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature would run a few times in Superman, but then it found a home in Superman Family, and it stayed in there till the end. And that strip was the reason I bought Superman Family for that. I mean, it wasn't usually the cover feature. Usually Supergirl was, but I would buy Superman Family just to get the Mr. and Mrs. Superman stories. I got to be honest here. I love this comic. No bones about it. Like I said, I saw ads of it as a kid. I've always been a fan of the Earth 2 Superman. I first encountered him in All-Star Comics number 74, which was the last issue of All-Star Comics, when I was like 3. So, but yeah, this just Bates does a great job. He comes up with a very convincing way for Lois to fall in love with Clark and not Superman. You know, he doesn't deny Lois was annoying and self-absorbed either. She kind of grows as Clark does, you know.
Yeah.
Which is nice. I mean, he doesn't try to sweep it under the rug that Lois was a pain in the neck back in those comics. Always trying to just expose him to get a story, you know, and prove a point. But, you know, they reference that early on. But, you know, she sees a change in him and he brings out the best in her. So the wizard really did a great thing when what he did. What did you think of it?
Again, like I said, I mean, to me, this is one of those things that, you know, all the wizard's spell did was get rid of the facade of Superman. And you see Clark Kent coming up to the forefront and bringing in all of the facets of his personality. And also, Lois tries to do what she considers the right thing by leaving. Even though she loves him, she thinks she wants to give the world Superman, even though it'll cost her Superman. He's like, no, you're my other half. You got to come, you know.
Right.
We got to be together.
Right.
So, to me, I mean, this shows that Lois Lane was a good person, and it shows that Clark Kent, you know, like, Bruce Wayne is Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Superman is Clark Kent.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. It's his upbringing and.
Right.
And with the Earth 2 Superman, he didn't learn of his Kryptonian origins until later. So in a lot of ways, he is more similar to the post-crisis Superman than the Earth 1 Superman was, because they both relied more on their Earth upbringing, and their Kryptonian heritage didn't mean as much to him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously it means something to him because they get married in Kryptonian
right
at the end of this, but he was less Kal-El than the Earth 1 Superman.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good, that's another, so really, you know, when the Earth, the post-crisis Superman appeared, which we'll get to shortly, he was, in more ways than you think, really, an amalgamation of the two previous Superman, really. So, well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will discuss the post-crisis Superman and the wedding of him and his Lois Lane.
Superman.
Captain Marvel.
Batman.
It is 1985.
Robin of Earth 2.
Sergeant Rock.
The Legion of Superheroes.
This is the most eagerly awaited comic book event in 50 years.
Tommy Tomorrow.
Jonah Hex.
Commandy.
It will one day be called the greatest comic book event of all time.
Swamp Thing.
Wonder Woman.
The New Teen Titans.
The Haunted Tank.
Infinity Incorporated.
Worlds will live.
Green Arrow.
Worlds will die.
Supergirl.
The Flash.
And that is only the beginning.
The Justice League of America.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Huntress.
Ariana.
The Metal Man.
Firestorm. The Nuclear Man.
The Outsiders.
Green Lantern.
The Blue Beetle.
The Crime Syndicate.
Warlord.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Tales of the Justice Society of America proudly presents...
And many, many more.
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same.
Coming January, only at twotruefreaks.com.
Okay, so now we're back, and we're going to talk about the comic we said we're going to talk about, which is Superman, the Wedding Album, from December 1996, on sale October 9th, 1996.
Which is actually the year you and I got married.
Right, right. We got married in January, but yep. So there's no cover art on our copy, but the alternative cover was by John Byrne. You want me to go through this list?
Oh, heck, I ain't reading all that.
This is from Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics, which is always a great resource. But rather than write it down from the comic, I just copied and pasted from his site. So, writer-penciler Dan Jurgens, writers Carl Kiesel, David Michelinie, Louise Simonson, Roger Stern. Pencilers were John Byrne, Kerry Gamble, Gil Kane, Stuart Immonen, Paul Ryan, John Bogdanov, Kieran Dwyer, Tom Grummett, Dick Giordano, Jim Moody, Kurt Swan, the 1978 Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, Barry Kitson, Ron Friends, artists Nick Cardy, Al Plastino, Gabe Kaplan, inkers Terry Austin, Murphy Anderson, Linda Carter, Bob McLeod, Adam West, Jose Marzon Jr., Dennis Janke, Doug Hazelwood, Dennis Rodier, Art Thierbert, George Perez, Jackson Geis, Ray McCarthy, Joseph Rubenstein, Jerry Ordway, and Jerry Mathers as the Beaver. Letterer, Bill Oakley. Colorist, Glenn Whitmore. Editor, Joey Cavalieri. You should listen to the Two True Freaks did a Christmas special. And the whole special was nothing but them introducing who was on the special. And it was just a list of names. It went on for 20 minutes. It was hilarious. But anyway.
Okay. Phew. Okay. Anyway, to get on this, I got choked up. Our story opens with Lois Lane in a wedding gown. It appears she plans to marry Naga, an international drug lord, on his way to the States. Lois turns the tables on Naga and his goons, and when the plane lands, she has them and their pilot captured.
At the Daily Planet, interim managing editor Clark Kent deals with the daily grind and ponders where his former fiancée is, lamenting the dissolution of their engagement. As if on cue, Lois walks in, tattered wedding gown and all. The Planet staff retreats, fearing the confrontation sure to come. Lois learns a great many things have occurred since she left Metropolis, including Perry White having cancer and Clark losing his powers. When Clark cuts himself and bleeds, Lois reaches in his pocket for his handkerchief and discovers her engagement ring inside. The two embrace and kiss, burying their recent antagonism toward each other, and the wedding is back on.
Over the next several days, wedding preparations are underway.
Clark informs Jimmy Olsen he doesn't want him to take photos for the wedding, citing Jimmy is now too important as a TV celebrity for WGBS to go back to his old role. Jimmy takes this hard, thinking Clark is angry with him. Martha Kent takes Lois out to look at dresses while the Lane family plan Lois's wedding shower. Clark and his father, Jonathan Kent, arrive for their tuxedo fittings, only to find an aggressive Sam Lane angry at Clark for dumping his daughter.
Lois then endures a shower themed to domestic slavery, and then goes through a series of wedding dresses before coming upon the perfect design. Clark takes Lois's engagement ring to a jeweler so he can have a tiny S shield engraved on the diamond itself. Lois and Martha go apartment hunting, but the perfect one is unattainable. Later, Lois bumps into Maggie Sawyer, who relates a tale of Superman saving the Aso Club's building from arson. The apartment above, however, is still a wreck and unlivable as an apartment. On his way to his bachelor party, a powerless Superman stops an armed robber and runs into Maxima, who offers the Man of Steel another chance to be her consort. When she realizes he's powerless, she flies off in disgust. Jonathan and Martha visit with the Whites, and the recovering Perry vows to be at the wedding.
At the Ace of Clubs, a bachelor party begins, but bar regular Meat. What a great nickname there.
He was in Porky's.
You are getting punchy, my friend. Doesn't like the idea of a private party without him. He starts trouble, so Bibbo throws him out through the window. Unfortunately, once the entire party has arrived, except for the groom, Meat, and his biker gang return, and an old-fashioned bar brawl ensues.
It's a much more polished affair at Lois's bachelorette party. That is, until a lech tries to make his move on Lois. She trips him and he falls face first into her cake. Traveling across town on foot, Superman comes across Naga and his men, escaped from jail. Despite his lack of powers, the Man of Tomorrow charges in, but is badly outnumbered until the Batman arrives to help. The world's finest heroes discuss Superman's impending nuptials, with both agreeing he made the right choice, when they see Lois walk her cake-encrusted annoyance out the restaurant door.
Batman tells his friend not to worry, that he has a contingent of heroes on guard from Metropolis, while he and Lois are off honeymooning. He also informs him that Bruce Wayne has arranged for the newlyweds to get that apartment they were after. A thankful Superman shakes hands with the Dark Knight and warns him he may be tarnishing his grim and gritty image.
Clark finally arrives at the bachelor party and informs an elated Jimmy that he wants him to be the best man. At the rehearsal dinner the night before the wedding, Sam Lane makes a scene. Lois will not let him walk her down the aisle, so Sam storms off, saying he won't attend.
The big day finally arrives, and Jimmy arranges for his WGBS crew to record the event. And of course, Lex Luthor has tapped into that feed and is watching from afar. Time-toss hero and former Lois stalker, the Alpha Centurion, arrives, and Clark receives an unwanted guest in the form of Mr. Mixelplick.
Mixelspidlick.
Whatever. Who informs his favorite playmate he now has two people to annoy before popping back to the fifth dimension. The wedding begins, and Lois, and the rest of the free world, is happy to see that Clark has gotten a haircut for the event. As the two exchange vows, Sam Lane sneaks in. The happy couple are pronounced man and wife and kiss before their supporting cast and visiting Superman creators past and present.
Okay. So this was a huge book.
Uh-huh.
Of course, Clark and Lois became engaged in Superman Volume 2, Number 50 in December 1990. That was the crisis of the Crimson Kryptonite, where Clark had lost his powers, and Superman even mentions that to Batman. It's funny, I had lost my powers when I proposed to Lois, and now we're getting married when I've lost my powers.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. The original idea was to marry them in 1993, but the Lois and Clark TV series was getting ready to start. So the people at DC and the people at Warner Brothers Television, they just thought it would be a good idea if they had them marry at the same time. So basically kind of like the Spider-Man deal.
Right.
So because they couldn't go ahead and marry them, they come up with the Death of Superman storyline.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, so they killed him instead. The TV episode aired on October 6th, the Sunday before this comic arrived in stores, so pretty well lined up.
Yeah.
Of course, by the time the TV episode aired, no one cared because they had screwed the fans over the previous year with a fake wedding where he married a clone that was made out of frogs or something. Remember that?
Yeah.
It was horrible. Yeah, Lois and Clark really went to the pits around that time. After they got married, it actually improved again. But
yes, but that...
Season 3
yeah. There's some real stinkers in that one. The Superman creative team had actually broke the happy couple up in Superman number 112 from June of 96, thinking the TV series wouldn't get around to their wedding until later. So when they got word they were going to marry him early in the season, they had to scramble to get the storyline truncated and put them back together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The cover we have is the wedding invitation cover. It's the Superman symbol embossed on a white cardstock cover. That's it. The alternate cover is by John Byrne, and I like John Byrne, but I think the cover's pretty blah. Lois isn't even that flattering. The drawing of it's not that flattering, I didn't think. But it is a nice bit that they start off Lois in a wedding gown, you know, especially given the breakup storyline, because, you know, that had to just shock people when they, you know, opened it. It would shock me when I opened it. Oh, she's got a wedding gown.
Already?
Yeah, wow. Yeah. It's kind of like when they, in Star Trek II, this is a tangent, but in Star Trek II, the reason that they kill Spock in the Kobayashi Maru scenario with the Saavik is because word had leaked out that Spock died. And so they thought, well, if we put this in here and we kill, air quotes, Spock in the beginning of the movie, then people say, oh, that's what they were talking about. And they'll be shocked when we really kill him.
Right.
So that's kind of what they did here. John Byrne actually starts off the story, which is only fitting because he started this version of Superman. Although I don't think Superman would have ever wanted to marry his version of Lois. She was a biatch. I mean, just straight up and down. She was, woo. That Roger Stern and Ordway and Juergens all softened her character a lot. And you liked her by the time they got engaged. But before, woo. Her speech balloons when she's talking to Naga are actually pink hearts, which is kind of cute. It points to the fact that
it's very cutesy.
It's all an act. But
right.
How dumb was this guy that he really thought that he had swayed this woman who was out to expose his drug cartel into marrying him?
You just answered your own question. He's a drug lord. He's drugged out of his freaking skull and sampling too much of his own product.
Maybe.
Duh.
Maybe. We do get a stereotypical Australian henchman who says, "Caw!" And, you know, then makes Crocodile Dundee references.
I know. That was bad.
This is a knife. You know. It's Australian for beer. You know. You know, I'm all for Lois being a capable character who can handle herself, doesn't need Superman to save her, but she takes out three armed men with a champagne bottle and a wedding cake.
Peggy Carter, same thing, on the show, and you were like, yay, rah, shut up.
Peggy Carter is a trained secret agent.
Lois Lane is an army brat who took all of the training.
Ooh, nice.
So, booyah!
Okay. The scene with Lois and Clark at the planet is really well done. They somehow managed to make their quick reconciliation work. Kudos to them for getting Stuart Immonen to do that part, because he was really good at these quiet moments and character interaction. They actually do make it's like, we're idiots. Let's get married. You know,
yeah,
I mean, it's like,
I mean,
we're being
but
stupid.
It's not the quick, you know, let's get married just because, you know, I proposed like in the Spider-Man and Mary Jane.
No.
This is, wait a minute, we really did mess up. I love you.
Yeah,
you know, it's,
right. It just feels,
it
seems
kind
of hypocritical of us to say one works and one doesn't, but it just does. This one works, and to our opinion, the other didn't.
Doesn't. There's no opinion, it's fact.
Okay. Paul Ryan, who illustrated that Spider-Man annuals, also one of the artists here, but you can see that his art's come a long way, and there's no Vince Coletta to, you know, erase and redraw his stuff, so it actually works really well. Jimmy is working for WGBS. Perry has cancer. Lori Lamaris is running around the surface world. This was kind of an odd time for the Superbooks, but, you know, that's what happens when you have a weekly serial. I mean, that's what the Superman books became, you know, with the triangle numbers, and it was damn good stuff back then. You know, I'm really hot and cold on John Bogdanov's stuff. Bogdanov, I think is how you pronounce it. Sometimes I love it. Sometimes I think it's just very haphazard and rushed. And his depiction of the Lanes and at the shower, it fell into that latter category. Lois just looks plain ugly.
And I say this, and I meant it. They look like caricatures. I mean, like taking one feature and then just exaggerating it. I mean, Lois Lane's jaw can cut through steel.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, but Superman's supposed to be the one with a square jaw, not her.
Right. Well,
and the chick, who did you say that was?
Well, now you pointed out, I didn't even put this in the notes, but you pointed out there's one scene where a woman's looking at the camera.
Yeah.
I think that's supposed to be his collaborator on the Man of Steel series, Louise Simonson.
Mm-hmm.
And she does look like a caricature, like you'd see at, like, you know, amusement park or the mall,
yeah,
or something. I mean, she really does. And she's looking straight at the camera. There's a lot of those cameos in here, but that one's really just
in
your face.
Is that the one with the big pink hat?
And she's got the little dog. And
I'm sorry, this is what I was going to say. If y'all have ever seen Ashley Tisdale in High School Musical, she portrays Sharpay. Big blonde hair, little bitty dog.
Yeah.
Looks just like her. Ashley Tisdale. Look it up. You'll be like, oh my God, that's it.
Well, it's kind of weird because Louise Simonson was the model for the woman on the first Swamp Thing appearance in House of Secrets. So it's, you know, she's been used before, but it's just kind of out of place. But yeah, and he sneaks Jeanette Kahn in there, you know, the DC publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And his version of her is quite frightening.
Was he mad at her?
Yeah. I don't know. If I was her, I'd been like, redraw that. And I like his stuff on a lot of other stuff, but I don't know if it was the time crunch on this one or, you know, I hate to like bash it, but it sticks out like a sore thumb in this book.
I'm telling you, and like where the part where he has Sam Lane going, you know, doing the triple take, and I'm like, really? This isn't that kind of comic.
This isn't a Looney Tunes comic, right? He does draw the sequence where Clark takes the ring to the jeweler, and I like his Clark Kent. He's got a very George Reevesy look to him.
Right.
The part where he gets the S etched into the ring is just kind of weird. Do you think it's a little weird? Or I mean, it's like nobody's going to see it. I guess that's their little secret, I guess, but it's kind of, you know, you don't want to spread that around. That's for sure. Cause,
well, and why couldn't he? What I don't understand is why couldn't he do it himself?
With telescopic and
microscopic laser vision,
microscopic and heat vision.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Why couldn't he do it himself? He's etched it in other comics. Why do you have to take it to, you know?
Well, he said he took it to the son of the jeweler that Pa Kent got Ma Kent's ring. But yeah, I don't know.
No, that's
why didn't he just take a couple lumps of coal and you know make her?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but that was just no.
Or the Adventures of Superman episode last night where he takes several diamonds and makes them into one big one.
Yeah. And talking about the bridal shower, what's with Lori Lamaris in the fish scale top? I mean, let's telegraph who this is. And she even has seashell earrings.
She's probably got a seashell bra on, you know. It's under the sea with Ariel.
But, I mean, come on. How about telegraphing just a wee bit?
Her and Mira shop at the same store. I don't really remember what the deal was with Lori being in Metropolis at the time. I know that caused some friction between Clark and Lois, and then Alpha Centurion was this time-tossed leftover from Zero Hour because he had loved Lois in an alternate reality or some crap where Superman didn't exist. I mean, it wasn't a bad story, but I really just didn't like the character at all when he showed up in the regular books. But anyway, the flashback with Superman and Maggie Sawyer was put in so Kurt Swan would have some art in the book. He had apparently drawn these pages quite a bit earlier, but they hadn't been published. I don't know what they were for, but he had passed away in June of 96, so just a few months, probably as they were preparing this.
Mm.
I'm not a big fan of Jackson Geiss's inks on him, because DC had a habit at this point of sticking heavy inkers on the old guard when they used them, like Bill Sienkiewicz. They stuck him on Jim Aparo every time he showed up, and it just did not work, but it was nice that they gave, you know, Kurt Swan was in it, though.
Let's talk about the wedding dresses. We got three to look at here.
Okay.
After the bridal shower, this is so funny because the first wedding dress, she looks like Maid Marian.
Yeah.
But the dress itself, remember the nightgown that my grandmother bought me for our wedding night?
I don't remember it.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same thing minus the puffy sleeves. I kid you not, this is pretty much...
That's Jeanette Kahn there.
Again... Somebody, he was mad at her.
Yeah, it looked like the Joker got a hold of her.
Yeah. But, again, it looks like what my grandmother bought.
Yeah. I like Tom Grummett's wedding dress.
Why didn't they use that one?
Yeah.
I mean, that is really, really pretty.
Lava Loon, lots of cleavage.
Yeah. But I mean, it's really pretty. And I think it suited her personality actually more than what they ended up using.
Yeah, yeah. The one they end up using is a little. I mean, Lois isn't like, here's my boobs, but
no,
she's also
no,
not.
But she's more, you know, I am woman, hear me roar.
Right.
You know, and
right.
I actually like this one. I really do. And I like it better than what they ended up using.
What do you think about the third one?
In and of itself, the one that they used, it's beautiful. And I would love to have worn something like that. But, you know, as for Lois, as the character they've portrayed, this fits her better.
Right.
The third one that they're using that has the open, you know, and where it's a mini skirt underneath.
Yeah.
I mean,
I like the top of it, but I don't like the mini skirt part.
Yeah.
It just seems kind of like she's almost like she's got a coat on.
Yeah, and where it's buttoned, the three big buttons at the top.
Yeah.
I mean, it's okay, but
right.
I honestly think for the character of Lois Lane, that second one fit her better. I mean, I like the last one for myself, but the second one fit the character of Lois better.
Now, it seems like, you know, it makes me wonder if Tom Grumman and Stuart Immonen didn't turn in these as potential designs.
Uh-huh.
Now, the John Bogdanov one, I'm sure, was a joke. I don't think anybody would have wanted that.
No.
But, you know, the other two were actually maybe potential wedding dresses for
right.
her. Because DC was into that at that time. They did, you know, they published a book that was all the designs that people would come up for Batman and
Robin and
different
yeah.
things. They were into doing that. And even in the 70s, they did that. Supergirl wore costumes designed by fans, and they'd show them. And so it's not unheard of at DC. We do get a close-up of Lois by Nick Carty, so you get those eyes you don't like, you Philistine. It's on this page.
Again, you know, on page 46... She's too young looking. It doesn't fit.
No, it's Nick.
It's not as bad as with Mira. To me, the pupils actually fill up more of the space.
To me, you can't put the words "bad" and Nick Carty together. But okay.
Don't ask for my opinion if you don't want it.
I know. So you got Nick Carty. He hadn't done anything Superman related in years, and even longer, it had been even longer, I think, for Al Plastino, who was one of the main Superman artists back in the 50s and, well, up in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So it's nice that he got the call to work on this one. I bet you he felt pretty silly giving Clark Kent a ponytail, though. The Maxima scene seemed kind of unnecessary.
Oh, yeah, it was. I mean, why even have her in there?
But, you know, it was probably either she had just appeared or was getting ready to come back in a storyline, I imagine.
Yeah, but they should have just left that out.
Yeah. I didn't reread the books preceding or following this for the show, so.
So don't nail us on that. You know?
Yeah. Superman having to have Batman save his hide in his own book seems a bit sorry. This is his wedding issue, and Batman has to show up and save him, but.
And I'm sorry, but, well, go ahead and talk about this double page spread thing, and then I will give you my thought on this.
So the double page spread with all the heroes is cool. You know, Batman's like, you know, it's taken care of or something, you know, and you know, Superman looks up and you see Green Arrow, Connor Hawk, Superboy, the Con-El, you know, clone, Black Canary, Robin, Tim Drake, Wonder Woman, Steel, Martian Manhunter, Captain Marvel, Kyle Rayner, Green Lantern, the Guardian, Alpha Centurion, yay, and the Flash, Wally. So you see all those guys like race across in a double page spread.
See, I have yet to figure out in a world with superheroes why there's any crime.
Because they have super villains.
I guess, but you know, it just kind of, what gets me though is Batman has all this money. He owns a building with the apartment that Clark and Lois want.
Right.
All he does is put their name at the top of the list so he gets the apartment. He doesn't give one of his best friends, you know, doesn't give him free rent for a year.
Well, Superman wouldn't want that, though. Clark wouldn't want that. He wouldn't want somebody to give him a handout. A hand up is one thing, but a handout's another. So.
Well, but, you know, old Brucey's got to make money, so, you know.
Well, I mean, he's got to fund all those contingency plans he has when Superman goes rogue.
So, in theory here, now think about this.
He's loaded.
Superman is paying to have his own ass kicked.
Yeah, he's like,
But Robin's like, that was really nice of you, Batman. It's like, I had the room loaded with kryptonite. I can turn it on at any moment.
And here's the thing. It's, you're talking about, now think about this. It's an apartment building owned by Batman. Do you not think that Batman doesn't have their place bugged?
Yeah, exactly.
Because he's watching them.
Yeah.
It's you know, the whole thing, he's watching them.
Yeah.
Superman just handed him, here, buddy, here's x-ray specs for you for my private life.
Yeah.
There you go.
And if you go into the animated series where Bruce and Lois had a thing, it's getting, you know.
I could say something really bad, but apparently I've been accused of being blue, so I won't go there.
Oh, moving on, I had forgotten the Whites had adopted Keith.
And where did you say he came from?
Why are you asking me this on air? I haven't looked this up forever. He was a character that primarily appeared in the Man of Steel book that was by Louise Simonson and John Bogdanov. And I think he was being raised by his aunt, if I remember right. She was a big, boisterous, large African-American lady. I can't think of her name. You know, she was a supporting character. And I think she got killed in one of the storylines. I think. I could be wrong. And the Whites adopted him. That is just me off the top of my head. I haven't read those comics in years. But I had forgotten that until, like, reading back through this. Sam Lane is an ass, okay? You know, mm-hmm. he just is.
I can't figure out why his wife stayed married to him.
I can't either. You know, clearly Lois is sticking the screws to him. She's getting revenge on him for treating her like a boy and being disappointed she wasn't a boy all these years. So she says, well, you wouldn't give away a boy, so you can't give away me. You know, so
well,
she's
and,
being
you know,
a little...
you don't get to revel in one of the joys of having a daughter is walking her down the aisle.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, she's needling him probably more than she should, but he's just a big jerkhead. But, of course, we had to have Lex in here somewhere. This was an odd time for Lex. This was the post-Luthor Jr., I've gone mad, clone body deteriorating Lex. This is, I think he made a deal with Neron during the Underworld Unleashed and got a healthy body back, so... He's got, you know, he's bald, but got the red eyebrows look going on.
Just stop and go to the next point. It makes my head hurt.
Okay, again, I really hate the Alpha Centurion. I just wish he went away. So, you know, it's a nice appearance by Mixie, who hints that we couldn't comprehend what he really looks like because he changes from the very cartoony John Bogdanov version to the more traditional Tom Grummet version.
Right.
And he says, well, you couldn't even comprehend what I really look like. This kind of points toward what Alan Moore did in... Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, when they finally see what he really looks like, and it's this strange mass of energy moving around, and it's horrific looking, which is weird. Thank God Clark got a haircut. Just, you know, I know it wasn't meant to be a mullet, and if Michael Bailey listened to this, his teeth are already starting to gnash, but a lot of artists drew it as a mullet.
Right.
And
they did.
And so the legend goes Superman...
Business in the front. Party in the back.
Yeah, so the legend goes that Superman had a mullet. I know he didn't really have a mullet. Dan Jurgens drew it as long hair when he first appeared. I think that was the way to draw it. It was just longer. It wasn't even incredibly long, usually, when Jurgens drew it. But, you know, to me, he should have had the long hair when he came out of the, you know, the chamber in the fortress.
Right.
In the black suit, he should have had a beard, too. And then he shaved and got a haircut, you know, and
right.
Then no long-haired Superman. But anyway, I'm glad they went with Jurgens and Ordway when they actually did the actual Clark and Lois walking down the aisle in the actual ceremony, because they were the only way to go for that iconic look of the time. They were the Superman guys when Byrne left, basically, and although Ordway had kind of moved on, he came back for this, you know, and I'm glad... That they did that. As they walk down the aisle, you can actually see Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson behind them. And there's several people peppered throughout this, including the last page. But the pastor is Jerry Siegel. He looks like Jerry Siegel, which is a nice nod.
I'm sorry, but again, I make the point that this is a bunch of dudes that primarily wrote this. Because there is no way that any woman worth her salt is going to let her husband-to-be, say, you know what? I think I'll wait until the night before to tell the best man that he's going to be the best man. There's a tux to be fitted. There's all that stuff to do. You know, all these other people, you know, now you think about it. You know, Clark and, Oh, Sam Lane and Jonathan went and got their tux fitted like the week before the ceremony.
Right.
They're not telling poor old Jimmy Olsen till the day before. Does he just have a tux hanging around?
And we assume that Pete Ross and he's commissioner now, Commissioner Henderson, got their tuxes fitted as well. Earlier.
See, yeah, and they don't tell the best man. I'm sorry, but again, you can tell a bunch of dudes did this.
With one woman, Louise Simonson. Yeah,
and I'm just like, no. No. I mean, let's be honest. When did you, I mean, Jason Todd was your best man when we got married.
Not Rob and Jason Todd, different Jason Todd, but yeah.
Jason Allen. But anyway, you told him like months before we got married. You all went and got your all's tuxes fitted like a month before.
Right.
Hello? Yeah. Timeline.
But in his defense, Jimmy is
and
now...
And we had a small wedding. We didn't have the ginormous thing that Clark Kent and Lois Lane had.
Well, that's true. But in his defense, Jimmy is now a TV celebrity. He may have had a tuxedo to wear. I'm just saying.
But Superman, being Superman, should have known that him saying, you know what, I don't want you to do that. You can just attend. You know that he could have had enough sense to realize that would have hurt his feelings.
Well, it happened because comics, because copyright Michael Bailey, because they had to have some kind of dramatic hook for, you know, with Jimmy. And so they had to give Jimmy
I'm sorry, but no.
Okay.
Any woman worth her salt would not let her husband-to-be do that.
Okay.
You're just glossing over that fact because it bugs me.
No, I don't. I think I agree. It was silly, but it was just because of the plot required it. But, you know, Clark, there's actually one panel where Clark looks positively Chris Reeve-like when he places the ring on Lois's finger, which I think is neat. The last page is actually a fold-out, and when you fold it out, you see the couple kiss, and above them there's an image of Superman kissing Lois, and then in the pews there's a bevy of Superman creators in the pews. Off the top of my head, I can make out Joe Shuster, Carl Kiesel, Roger Stern, Jerry Ordway, Dan Jurgens, Mike Carlin, Jeanette Kahn, Paul Levitz, and Julia Schwartz. I'm sure there were others, and there were other people that were supposed to be somebody, but off the top of my head, I couldn't identify them. You know, this comic was just as, if not more, rushed than the Spider-Man issue, but it just doesn't feel as forced. It doesn't feel forced. I don't
know
if they had...
Because it's a natural progression. People were willing to work on it. People thought it was a good idea.
This is where we need to be, yeah. This is where we need to go, yeah.
And, I mean, just like when you're... Whenever you work on any project, if you believe in a project, if you think, hey, this is where it needs to be, this is what needs to be done, you work better and more effectively. And this shows.
Right. I mean, you can just tell that they had a good time working on this. Now, some of this may have been done beforehand and they, you know, pulled it back out and reworked parts of it. I don't know that. But, I, you know, either way, it didn't feel rushed, and other than John Bogdanov's art in that one section. But it felt like everybody took their time and enjoyed doing it. You know, it's similar, again, to the Spider-Man wedding because it follows them and their supporting cast in the days leading up to the wedding. Mm-hmm. But once Lois and Clark get over their issue, and they were actually broken up, then it's done, and they're moving on.
Right.
There's none of this second guessing. There's no cold feet. They're getting married.
There's no both of them being late to the wedding.
Right. There's no car ride
on the steps of a building when it could have been raining.
There's no car ride in some other dude's Ferrari who wants to, you know, bed you. I mean, there's none of that.
Guaranteed that's where the tickets come from.
But, you know, this was the Superman books at the time, because it was weekly, they did a really, you know, the supporting cast, their storylines were part of the comic. I mean, you were as interested in what was going on with them as you were with Superman and Lois. And even though we didn't read the books leading up to this or after this, the creators had such a good handle on the characters, you could drop right in and kind of pick up where they were at. And that's just a testament to how good the Superman books were
at that time.
And actually, this is toward the end of the time that I really liked of the books. I think their best period was kind of behind them, but it was still really good. And it was just good comics. So you got anything else on this one?
No, I mean, I think I've said, you know, everything I can say about it. So
okay. Well, I think we'll talk a little bit about what we're planning on doing coming up. We've actually got quite a bit of feedback, and we haven't done a feedback episode in a long time.
Oh, we haven't?
So, no. So, we really need to do a feedback episode, and I could use a break from doing all these notes. So, we may or may not next time do a feedback episode, but we will do one soon. But another thing that's coming up, either this time or next time, there's a series that me and Cindy both love. And we've been talking about, well, how do we want to do it? We want to cover this book, but where do we start? What storyline do we cover? And, you know, we just talked about it and we're like, you know what? Let's just start at the beginning and we'll cover it as we go along in between other subjects. We'll stop and occasionally cover
this. Whenever we get stuck for an idea, we're going to do this. Let's be honest and call a spade a spade.
Well, that's partially it, but partially because we just want to
do it. Oh, yeah, but we don't want to do a whole run of this 100 issue.
No, close to 100, yeah. So what we're talking about is James Robinson's Starman.
Da-da-da-da!
Yeah, so we're talking about doing the Jack Knight Starman series. There was a Starman podcast that covered Ted Knight's adventures, but off the top of my head, and if there is one, I apologize. I don't think there is a Jack Knight Starman series. And if you write in and tell me there is, it probably still ain't going to change anything because we want to talk about it. And I'm sure our perspective's different. And we're not going to have a separate show anyway. But we're going to have an occasional feature that covers several issues of Starman. So that may be next time or the time after that. It's just according to how things work out. It might be a feedback episode next time because you guys have been writing in and we've got feedback to go over. And please give us more. It'd be great to have more feedback. If you can get it in, you know, in the next little bit after this one comes out, hopefully we can get it in the episode. And if you've got, if you want to give us a review on iTunes, you can do that. You can send us feedback at supermatespodcast@gmail.com or leave a comment on the blog, which is supermatescomic.blogspot.com.
Or on our Facebook page.
Yes, we're on Facebook. You can leave us a comment there. And we pulled comments from all those places. It's in a document waiting to be read on a upcoming episode. So we will get to your comments on the air. That's it. Thanks for helping us celebrate our 1 year anniversary. And we'll
congratulations to Lois and Clark, and God have mercy on Mary Jane and Peter's soul.
Well, they had to deal with the devil, so. To straighten all that out, so I don't know there's any hope for their souls. That was a good way to end it. See ya. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin & Franklin production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The fictional characters and events mentioned in this show are trademark and copyright their respective owners. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their owners, and we mean no infringement by either. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
Can you read my mind? What it is that you do to me? I don't know who you are. Just a friend from another star. Here I am, like a kid out of school, holding hands with a god. Quivering like a little girl shivering. You can see right through me. Can you read my mind? Can you picture the things I'm thinking of? Wondering why you are. Wonderful things you are. You can fly. You belong in the sky. You and I could belong to each other. If you need a friend, I'm the one to fly to. You need to be loved. Here I am. Read my mind.
Now, what was it you were going to ask me?
I'm not very good with words, Miss Lane.
Lois.
Lois. But, excuse me. This will probably be a little expensive, but it's worth it.
What are you doing?
Squeezing little diamonds into one big one. See? Now, what I wanted to ask you was, will you marry me?